This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Patricia Pearson takes on the subject of dread in her new book. She reports that here in North America, in the land of the brave, the home of the free, 40 million of us are in anxiety's grip. Patricia Pearson is a writer. She's a novelist, humorist, and journalist. Her latest book is A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. A Kirkus review describes the book as playful and poetic, a wholly satisfying mix of memoir, cultural history, and investigative journalism. With Patricia Pearson as our knowing, gentle, and funny guide this afternoon, we are going to take a look at anxiety. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Your questions and comments for our guest, Patricia Pearson, are welcome. Our conversation is open to you. All you need to do is give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Patricia Pearson is a contributing editorial writer for USA Today. Her commentary has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times, The New York Observer, and The Guardian. Her previous books include the novel Playing House, an essay collection, Area Woman Blows Gasket, and a nonfiction book on female aggression when she was bad. She is the granddaughter of the Nobel Prize-winning Canadian Prime Minister, Lester Pearson. Patricia Pearson's new book, A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine, is published by Bloomsbury. And you'll find our guest on the web at www.pearsonspost.com. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Patricia Pearson, good afternoon. Welcome. How are you?
Hi, Celeste. I'm good. I've got a pair of giggling 8-year-olds upstairs who might break through into your radio show.
That's fine. I would love to hear them. I would love to hear giggling 8-year-olds. You know, I had no idea there was such a thing as powdered butter.
Oh.
Would you tell us the story you tell on yourself at the outset of the book about being anxious about influenza?
Yes. What happened to me, and this is very common with people when they're suffering from anxiety, is that you tend to displace what's more deeply making you anxious into something that you feel you can control or do something about. So I was actually feeling quite anxious at that time in 2006 about finances. But instead of that occurring to me, instead I got embroiled in this idea that we were all going to die of avian flu. And so I started to join this group on the Internet called the Flu Wiki. I think they're still going, actually. That post all kinds of advice on how to protect yourself when the avian flu pandemic hits the world and sort of repeats the calamity of 1918. And in the process of that, I got onto a site called Survival Acres, which is doing a robust profit in catering to neurotics by providing you with all kinds of... They had packages, and there was one that was like a $500 combo package that included powdered butter and a whole variety of other dehydrated foods that you could store away in your basement so that when the pandemic flu hit, you could self-quarantine and never leave your house for 3 months and subsist on, you know, granola and pancakes. So that's what I got into. I still have it. I don't know what to do with it now.
Powdered butter.
Mm-hmm.
I read that aloud to my husband last night, and... We found ourselves, you know, laughing and then thinking, well, you know, that's what we've been told.
Yeah.
Is to have this stuff in the basement. And it harkens back a little bit to the aftermath of September 11th when we were told about sheets of plastic and duct tape.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a certain degree of prudence to having emergency supplies on hand, for sure. But it's the way that you take anything that could have a sort of valid degree of threat and then extrapolate and blow it up that sort of characterizes this kind of anxiety.
Yeah. And Flu Wiki is still around.
I think it's still around.
Yeah, I checked it out this morning.
Oh, is it?
Yep, still there.
Yeah, so they're very dogged. It's kind of like people who just keep waiting for the apocalypse that's supposed to come on a certain day.
Well, What is anxiety? Is it the same, similar to, or completely different from fear and being afraid?
I think they're quite different. Fear is more of an actionable experience, so that fear would be something where you have an immediate and clear threat presented to you. So, for instance, you know, you're walking down the street and a car suddenly veers toward the sidewalk and you jump out of the way and you have a great upswelling of adrenaline and flushed cheeks and, you know, breathing and so on. And that's fear, but you've taken action and then it resolves itself. Whereas what happens with anxiety is that you have the same physical response. So you have the same sense of, you know, difficulty breathing sometimes and heart beating loudly and so on, but you don't have anything you can do, you can take action against. There's no, the threat is more objectless. It's more, it tends to be more internal and more deep in you, and you can't figure out what is making you anxious. So then you go and look for something, which is why sometimes anxiety has been called fear in search of a cause.
Mm. Is there a purpose for anxiety?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a purpose for, you know, what we would have evolved as being a kind of bracing alertness. So, you know, without anxiety, you would, well, for a number of things. For instance, we know from fMRI imaging that sociopaths and psychopaths have no fear. They don't experience fear. And one result of this is that they have no fear of social censure, so they don't care what you think of them. They have a basic immorality. So in some ways, anxiety and fear help to bind us socially and emotionally and make us more compassionate and caring, because we care and we fear other people's disapproval. And then, of course, there's just a sort of basic level of becoming high-tuned. Like, I was watching my daughter before a gymnastics competition recently, and she was highly, highly anxious in the immediate, but it focused and clarified her. So that, and then, of course, she pulled it off and was, and, you know, failed to fall off the beam or whatever. So there's that kind of, what happens when it becomes disordered anxiety is that it's not preparatory to anything. It just bends out.
Yeah. I was thinking about the anxiety dream. I suspect this is something that's pretty universal, although I don't know. But from time to time, I have these, and that's a way to kind of work through. Maybe it's in reaction to anxiety. Maybe it's preparing for anxious moments. But it's something that you work through the issue in your while you're asleep.
I think that's true. In fact, when I'm in my highest moments of overt anxiety, for instance, when I'm actively buying buttered powder or powdered butter or whatever, I don't have nightmares or anxious dreams because it's on the surface. Whereas conversely, when I'm, you know, when my surface life is fairly placid, then that's where I'll start to have occasional nightmares. So the more, and similarly, sometimes it goes into your dreams, and sometimes the other direction that it sinks into is your physical self. So that, for instance, the older generation of men, I'm not so sure of this generation, but my father's generation would manifest anxiety in physical ways. So he would be dizzy, he would get stomach pain, he would think he was having a heart attack. So the anxiety would sink beneath the surface into his physical self.
Is it our brains, our psyches telling us we need to take a break? Could that also be at work?
It's possible. I think in different circumstances that would be one issue. But I think what it tends to be more provoked by is a sense of not having control, so a sense of helplessness. And I think one of the reasons that anxiety is higher or more prevalent in Western secular North American culture is because there is much more a focus on the individual, and the individual rises or falls on their own merits. So we are much more putatively in charge of not only of our economic status, but also of creating meaning in the world around us than, say, if you were living in a kind of deeply Catholic small rural community, for instance, in Latin America, where the anxiety levels are actually much lower. So the more that we ourselves feel responsible for what happens, I think the more that anxiety gets generated.
Yeah. One of the things you write about in the book are some of the things that you write about in the book are, you know, is, oh boy, I'm really screwing this up good here. You talk about philosophers and Rollo May, for example,
yeah.
and the existentialist and this dread of non-being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took me a while to figure out what that... I was terrible in philosophy in university, so I couldn't... I had to reread these texts quite a bit to sort of sort them out and try to, you know, translate them for my book. But I think that the very important point that was being made, particularly by Paul Tillich, who I think lived in Chicago, was that, you know, we have a terrible fear, not so much of dying, not a fear of death creating anxiety, but a fear of being almost ghostly, of making no impact, of not being witnessed, of non-being in that sense. So it's not like so much the fear of dying, but the fear of failing to make a mark, fear of invisibility that underlies a lot, particularly, I think, in modern society where it's your meaning is much more ephemeral and elusive, and it's hard to kind of figure out your status.
Yeah. Well, at the outset to the chapter titled Fear's Geography, you have an epigraph from Yifu Tuan,
mm-hmm.
Landscapes of Fear. Who is or who was he?
He was, I think he's still alive. Actually, I can't remember where he is. He's not in Indiana or Illinois, but he's, anyway, he's a cultural geographer, and he's one of those people like Simon Shama that just has these sort of great eclectic curiosities.
Uh-huh.
And at one point in the 70s, he got interested in this idea of the cultural geography of fear. And he wrote about, what was it in landscapes that would generate more or less anxiety and dread in human beings. And it's a really, really interesting book. It's quite unique. And one of the things he was talking about was certain communities in, of course, now I can't remember where they were, but there was one of them was in the rainforest, and not perhaps in the Congo, or anyway, somewhere in the rainforest, where you have this community that really has no vocabulary at all for dread or anxiety, because they're living in such sort of harmonious entanglement with their environment that there's no sense of other, there's no sense of threat or anything that they're opposed to. The weather is very, serene. The food is abundant. The water is clean. They don't have. It's not a complex society, and so that's what he was looking at: was what are the ways in which the worlds in which we inhabit change our levels of anxiety?
It's an interesting concept.
Really,
harmonious entanglement.
Oh yeah, I just made that up.
I know. Well, yeah, I think it's something to think about. Where can we find that today? Is it possible to find that? Maybe you want to talk with us about your experience at the Checkerboard Lounge in Chicago.
Oh, well, that was an interesting experience for sure for me. And this was when I was in my early 20s. I was at the University of Chicago, which was at that time a very discordant environment. So because there was a lot, it was sort of at the height of the crack epidemic, there was a lot of violence around the campus at the University of Chicago, and my coursework was very, very difficult and demanding, and I was suffering from, that was my sort of first nervous breakdown actually was happening then. And one of the reasons that my anxiety got exacerbated was because I had no one acknowledging, there was no collective witnessing of my own experience of fear and upset. It was having been very precipitously left by my first great lover, my boyfriend, dropping me, and I couldn't wear widow's black. I wasn't a widow. I wasn't a divorcee. There was no collective acknowledgement. There was just, you know, get on with the business of the day and do it in this very, you know, hostile environment. And I found this strange kind of oasis one or two times at the Checkerboard Lounge because there was a sense of within that community of collective lament and sorrow and a certain recognition of that as being a part of life. And in the dancing, and in the not caring about being, you know, if the women there, you know, could have been 250 pounds and still moved beautifully and so on. If there wasn't that kind of sense of self-consciousness. And it came close to, and this is why I wrote about it in the book, the kinds of rituals that you do find in other cultures, in the Mexican fiesta, for example, where people collectively begin to acknowledge the strife and hardship within their lives. Mm. And that kind of environment, I think, is very healthy emotionally for us.
Yeah. And so often we lack it, or there might be periods in our lives when we lack it. For example, I'm thinking now about the high levels of anxiety among college students.
Yeah, very high.
Yeah.
And I think that part of the reason for that would be, at least this is, there's been some research to suggest this, and it certainly would be my guess that part of the reason for that is that you are coming into a period in your life where your relationships, your love relationships, have no value. They're devalued. There's a tremendous amount of kind of not only beer spilled on a frat house floor, but love and heartbreak. And so it's a very reckless period of time emotionally and spiritually for people, and that creates, I think, certainly it did for me, a tremendously high level of anxiety at that time.
Yeah. Well, there you were in Chicago, and.
Yeah.
You know, everybody is expected to, get on and move on and, be successful and do the work. There's a lot of pressure to perform well. Then there's fears about what lies ahead when you're finished with school.
Right.
And then you've got, the first great loves of your life. There's so much going on there, and then you're away from what you've known.
Yeah, that's another factor too. Yeah. So it's a very key period in breaking away from your sort of original family or original village or clan.
Yeah. So family is really important too. That's where you eventually found solace and comfort was with your sister.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I did. I went back to live with her for some time. And that was, and then sort of began to sort of gradually rebuild my life again without really learning the lesson. And I think this is one of the things I was trying to explain in my book, is that although I recovered from this period of anxiety, I didn't understand it. And it was very quickly medicalized. And then for, the ensuing however many years, I was made to understand that my anxiety was entirely a part of my physical self, the way some people would have recurrent bouts of gout or eczema or something, that I had an anxiety disorder, so that it wasn't the society around me that was making me vulnerable to feeling anxious or depressed. It was my chemistry, and that was the story that I had to to tell a different way when I was writing this book.
Yeah. When did anxiety become medicalized?
It's an interesting story, as is everything in psychiatry is always kind of swinging, over the last 200 years has swung back and forth between the physical and the psychoanalytical, or the physical and the spiritual, or it's always, it seesaws back and forth. And anxiety itself was originally coined by Freud, but primarily within the context of, a psychoanalytic phenomenon. It wasn't until, even though he was a neurologist, actually, but it wasn't until the advent of the physical treatments. So at first it was, I can't remember, before Valium there was something that came along that was an effective tranquilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And when that came along, and then Valium, and then some of the benzos as well, you created a treatment that required you to, recast the phenomenon as a physical thing so that you could then sell the treatment. So that the rise of medical psychiatry was very much from the outset kind of bound up with the pharmaceutical companies and what they were beginning to develop in their labs. And, of course, as you know, this whole thing is coming to a head right now with Congress even getting involved in this kind of very strange dance going on between the... So, and then, of course, then the boundaries got expanded, further and further, so that, suddenly what 200 years ago would have simply been, a period of despondency now becomes soft bipolar 2 and needs an antipsychotic and that sort of thing. So there has to be and is beginning to be a pushback against that medical framework now.
Mm. How many people are being treated for anxiety with drugs?
I would say that well, among the top 10 best-selling drugs in the United States, three of them are antidepressants. So you can kind of infer from that how many people would be. Generally speaking, and this I always find surprising, but what happens is that it's GPs primarily that distribute psychiatric drugs, not psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. And so often people who might have been able to avail themselves of talk therapy or of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is quite effective, or any number of different alternatives, they don't get told about them because their GPs are more specifically aware of the medications.
Hmm. What are your thoughts about when drugs are in order and when they should be, you know, last resort?
Well, I had an interesting conversation with someone the other day about this, who she has very severe obsessive compulsive disorder and has had it all her life. And she was saying to me, well, Patricia, you know, I have been on Paxil for 10 years and at a low dose, but I have to be, if I'm not on that low dose of Paxil, I cease to be able to function. So this dose, in combination with all the work that she's been doing, I guess, in cognitive behavioral stuff, enables her to continue. So there are certain forms of, and, you know, very, very recalcitrant depression, for instance, where these kinds of drugs, where it's, you know, the costs of them, which include some uncertain long-term, you know, neurocognitive problems that we're still not clear about, weight gain, all these sorts of things, are outweighed by the benefits. But for the majority of people that go and see, that are going through what are essentially life experiences, and this is what I, when I went back and looked at my own life, saw that primarily these were all just life experiences that were making me anxious. You can get out of these things through other ways without winding up being sort of embroiled in the pharmaceutical dependency, which is what happens, especially with some of them. Not all of them. Prozac's pretty benign that way, but some of them, it's very hard to get off.
Oh, it's interesting. I remember when my parents went through their divorce, and of course it was very upsetting, and my mother suggested, you know, she said, here's some Valium. And I said, you know, I think I'll get through it. So I didn't go there, but, you know, she did. And for her, that was good.
Well, I used to use Xanax for flying.
Oh, flying.
Which I found helpful.
Yeah.
Except one time it made me too relaxed and I missed the plane. Oh, never mind. I'll get there sooner or later.
And you didn't care, right?
I didn't care.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Patricia Pearson. She is the author most recently of A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. She's a writer. She's a novelist. She's a journalist. She's a humorist. She's a contributing editorial writer for USA Today. And I think this book, A Brief History of Anxiety, is now her fifth book. She's a novelist. Her novels include Playing House. She's also the author of an essay collection, Area Woman Blows Gasket. I love the title.
Thank you.
And a nonfiction book on female aggression, which was an award-winning nonfiction book, When She Was Bad. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Your stories are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I was surprised to learn through your book that Charles Darwin suffered from anxiety in his later years, which, you know, gets us to the question of when is anxiety likely to strike?
Well, I mean, it can strike at any time. I think with Darwin, his daughter died, and it was sometime after discovering natural selection and then his daughter dying, and that, I suspect, combination of factors. You know, sort of being the first person, literally the first person, to think there might be a way of explaining the world without God, which would be terrifying at the end of the day. And so he, and in his case, what he would do is he developed claustrophobia, so he became terrified of illness, and would go and have himself sprayed with a hose at the spa in Malvern in England. And this was at a time when this was sort of the first physical treatment for anxiety and depression was developed. Before those terms were being used, it was called nervous exhaustion. Was this idea that somehow waters were curative. So T.S. Eliot would go off to the lakes of Geneva, and Darwin would go to the spa in Malvern, and they were all getting themselves vigorously sprayed with various kinds of water.
Yeah, asylums also used that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So also Aretha Franklin and David Beckham?
Yeah, David Beckham apparently has OCD, and Aretha Franklin has always had this absolutely incapacitating fear of flying, which is one of the reasons why she rarely tours. So, you know, I live in Toronto, so I benefit from the fact that she can drive here from Detroit. So, you know, she will perform here and various places within driving distance, but she won't, unless she's, I mean, she may have conquered it by now, but for a long, long, long time, she was unable to fly.
Yeah. I saw her here in Champaign-Urbana a number of years ago, and I guess Champaign-Urbana would be within driving distance as well.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you write about in describing anxiety is the apprehension phase of it. Apprehension runs through us like an underground current. It electrifies when no one is watching. So how many of us do you suppose who aren't being treated or have it under control, how many of us, do you think 40% of us could that be 40 million of us rather, could that be a low number?
Oh, I think so. Although there's a degree to which anxiety has to do with your wiring. So children who are born with what's called a high reactive temperament will wind up being more prone, more vulnerable to feeling anxiety. So it's hard to tell. I mean, I do know people who go through, you know, extraordinarily what to me would be traumatic experiences without feeling that kind of apprehensiveness and that I've felt. So there is some degree of wiring about it. But I also think that what I was wanting to say about that in the book was that it's quite invisible. So we don't know what to look for in the anxious. It's not, we hide it. It's not, you can still function. You're not lying prone on the couch. It's a very easily concealed, and in that way, a very isolated experience. So it's hard to convey to people, and therefore people don't extend offers of help. To you when you're experiencing it. And I think it's probably getting worse right now, particularly in terms of the economy. I mean, it has to be.
Yeah. And also the pace of our lives and the media in our lives. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm just thinking that the media, in all manner of media, it's so surrounding. And I can remember feeling really anxious most recently, a few years back, when Katrina hit.
Yeah.
And I just found myself, I have to turn off the television. I have to turn off the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, certainly as somebody who's been in the media and has, you know, found myself contributing to that level of jangling sort of discord, I myself had to pull back. I stopped doing crime journalism because of that. It's not constructive. It doesn't provide people with anything useful to do. And also with the media, it's interesting because we think that that's just the way it has to be. But in fact, in various periods of history, including during World War II, the media was not persistently negative. It was actually, made a collective effort to bring more positive stories to light so that people would feel inspired rather than crushed. So, you know, we have sort of got ourselves in this kind of collective sort of hyperbolic, panicky loop. Yeah. And I remember a few years ago, I moved down with my family to for 6 months to Mexico, just north of Mexico City, to a little town. And indeed, when we took away the billboards and you took away the television and the radio and we only had sporadic connections on the internet, we were surrounded by fiesta and church and ritual. The pace of life was very slow. It really did make a difference. We really did come back to Toronto 6 months later feeling fundamentally more relaxed.
Mm. And was it relaxing for Clara as well?
Yes. Yeah, both of my children.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, coming back here was very, what's the word? It's, you know, somewhat alarming for them.
Yeah.
Because, and I remember sitting, the week I got back from Mexico, sitting in a business lunch and just being amazed at the tension in my colleague, just that she wasn't even aware of, just the degree of tenseness that she was projecting was, you know, the norm, but it was quite extraordinary when you step out of it for a while.
Yeah.
What we can do about that, I don't know.
Yeah. My husband and I have vacationed in a place where for miles and miles, there's only like maybe three stop signs, and life is much slower, much to the chagrin of the adolescents there. But when we get home, I feel a little, and Champaign-Urbana, you know, is is a very livable place, but I feel a little rattled by the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how was it that you got into crime reporting? I would think that that would have been not a natural choice.
Well, my curiosity has always, kind of galloped off without any interest or respect for my temperament. So when I was in my mid-20s, I just got really interested in the psychology of crime primarily. I think it was partly because of the atmosphere of the time. True crime was kind of at a height in terms of readership of people like Ann Rule, and there were a lot of really spectacular trials going on at that time with Ted Bundy and the Gotti crime family in New York. I went to their trial, Gambino. I mean, all of this kind of just before you got the police procedurals on television. So this was just beginning to heat up the interest in that and what we now see all the time with Law and Order and so on. And it just seemed like an area of boundarylessness where, how could people be that extreme and how could they, what was the difference between them and me? I didn't really think I was asking that out loud, but in fact, on some level, that's what interested me was, you know, are they really different? Is there something fundamentally different about these men who serial kill and these men in my life who dump me or the women who dump the men? I mean, what's the difference? So that's why I got interested in it. But, ultimately, like anything, it becomes quite toxic to immerse yourself in that kind of world. And I think police must certainly feel that a lot, and jurors get into that situation where it's quite traumatic after a while to be exposed to that degree of evil, essentially.
Mm.
So I did it for a few years, and then I backed away.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Patricia Pearson, author most recently of A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. That's our topic this afternoon, anxiety. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm just wanting to know, in your book, is there anything good that can come out of anxiety?
Well, I mean, yes, I do think so, because, I think anxiety partly becomes the way in which you can act as the canary in the coal mine, and maybe that's not right, the right expression, but you are more vigilant to what's down the road, to what the threats are. I was talking to a Jewish friend of mine whose parents had been in the Holocaust, who said, well, if my father hadn't anxiously moved to Poland in advance, was it a bad thing that he was so anxious that he got out of the way? And that's an interesting question. You know, is there a degree to which anxiety actually ultimately makes us, you know, think more creatively about where we're headed or what the threats are?
Yeah, I I think that's probably right. I know I've recently been reading some of the philosophy of Martin Heidegger.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned you'd studied some of the philosophers who'd also discussed anxiety. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, he kind of discussed it more as a fundamental mood that could be revealing to people. I mean, either in an authentic or inauthentic fashion.
Yeah.
It seemed that there would be, there could be some value in it. I guess I was a little surprised to hear how the medical profession is medicating it, you know, as opposed to maybe trying to deal with it, you know, in other other methods that don't use drugs.
Well, another way of putting what you're saying, I think, is that anxiety is a valuable signifier of what may be wrong in a culture that we should be paying attention to. Part of the reason why there's so much drug usage with it is because of the pressures from HMO. So it's, you know, it's a lot more efficient for them to stick you on a drug than to, you know, pay for 18 weeks of therapy or whatever. So... But we're flattening out what is in fact a kind of signifier of what may be wrong in our culture. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a shame. It seems like you're bringing up a real problem that hopefully people can start to address.
I hope so.
Okay. Look forward to looking at your book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. A listener also in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hi. I was fascinated by your conversation, and I just wanted to share a personal story that this week I was home unusually watching CNN during the afternoon when the earthquake hit in Los Angeles. And as I listened to the reporters, their voices rose. They started to speak in a faster voice and a higher tone. And, you know, as we know, that the earthquake in Los Angeles was not, a terrible tragedy. But almost immediately, this tone changed. And, you know, it's just to me an example of what you were talking about how, you know, even some people in the media can raise our anxiety. Certainly, I don't think they're doing that deliberately, but this excitement gets started.
Mm.
And I just observed that, and I thought I would share that with you.
I think that's interesting because I've actually seen research that shows that that people have a physiological response to a louder and rising voice. So this is in the context of when they talk about conflict resolution, and one of the things is that people don't realize that when their voices rise, do you say that, rise, then you're actually eliciting more strain and arousal in the other person. And that's a very good example of how that would be working through the media and having an impact on us.
Hmm. I wonder about the issue that the caller raised in terms of deliberateness. What do you think?
Well, I think having been in the media and that side of things, that it is. There is no question there's a deliberateness in that. I don't think in a cynical sense, but certainly in a competitive sense. And for instance, I've been trying to formulate a good news column, and I talked to an editor at USA Today about this, and they for the life of them, they can't figure out, well, why would anyone want to read good news? You know, that's boring.
Mm-hmm.
So you get caught in this cycle of believing that your viewers and your readers and your listeners only want to thrive on this kind of adrenaline-rushing sort of, stuff. And that if anything is good, then it's placid or it's you know, earnest or it's silly, which is, you know, ludicrous on the face of it when you think about it. But certainly that's, you know, it's very hard, I think, to get the media to shake itself out of that mode.
Yeah. Also, I think there's a temptation to when a news event happens and, you know, things aren't, we really don't know. And there's a hesitation, I think, to saying that. So the speculation starts to whirl.
Oh, that's so true. One of the funniest things I ever saw on The Onion, you know how they do those little video clips now?
I haven't seen those.
Oh, you've got to go see them. So these are, you know, parody news clips that you can find on theonion.com on their website. And one of them was the anchor reporting on, over his left, he said, a series of concentric-shaped circles is emanating from a red pulsating dot in the area over my left shoulder. And the whole thing was describing this graphic that you would usually see with a tsunami or something, but they didn't know what it was, so he got a concentric circle expert on to interview, and they're very, very on point about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, also there's the temptation to throw open the email, throw open the airwaves so people can get on and say what they think. And we all have a right to our opinion, but is it very useful? Sometimes it's not. It's just a lot of noise.
A lot of noise.
A lot of noise. So I don't know. Well, let's go back to the idea of, maybe before we wrap up, let's talk a little bit about anxiety that some of us suffer in beginning in childhood. Why is it that, it seems that nighttime and bedtime is particularly fraught with dread for some children?
Well, one of the reasons, which I learned in my research and found so interesting, is that the human startle reflex is potentiated by darkness. So in rodents, the startle reflex is potentiated by bright light. That's when they will freeze. That's when they'll get particularly nervous. They want to be, your hamster is nocturnal. It wants to be up at night, and rats and so on. Humans and other primates, their startle reflex is potentiated by darkness. And so we're putting children to bed often in their own rooms in darkness at precisely the time of day when they are the most arousable, the most fearful. So that's one factor. And then another one has to do with the degree to which the human mind is involved in inference. And what do I mean by that? Did you read that article in The New Yorker a little while ago about the woman who was itching?
Oh, my God, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So she had a phantom itch, and it wasn't really there, but she kept itching and itching in her head. And what they were talking about in the article is that the new research is showing that something like 80% of the world around us is based on what we imagine it is rather than what is received information. So they used to think it was quite the opposite, but now they realize that we are constructing meaning. 80% of my sense of the book being on the shelf as I talk to you right now in my office is my inference that that book is on that shelf. So when you take away light and you've got a child in the darkness and they're in a position of high arousability and high fearfulness, they start to make inferences about objects and shapes around them and noises.
Mm.
And it's a torment. I certainly remember it as being a constant torment when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, I was the only girl in a family of four, so I had my own room, and that was pretty spooky. My brothers had one another, but
phenomenon of North American affluence, because in most cultures, both historically and contemporaneously, people sleep together. Adults sleep with their kids in the same rooms, generally speaking, for space reasons, right?
Yeah.
But that's what people, humans, are used to.
Yeah. So for people who have a child anxious at bedtime, what would you recommend?
Well, my daughter is sort of repeating what I went through, and what I've done with her is I've made her, invent a series of actions that she can take to feel like she has some control over whether, in her case, she's always afraid a robber is going to come in through her window, and that's based on something she heard in the news about a girl being snatched in Toronto. So Clara has created a little robber baffle on her windowsill, and she's made it with tacks and clattery cans and things like that. And then she's got a whole list on her wall of things, actions to take, scream, this, that. And, none of these things necessarily are going to fundamentally make any difference to whether she gets stolen out of her room. But for her, the psychological trick is to make her feel that she's not totally helpless. And I think that helps. It also helps for her to just be able to roam freely around the house in the middle of the night and not feel that we're going to judge her if she winds up sleeping in the hallway floor or wherever she feels comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Maybe where there's a light on somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything you would like to say in summation here?
Just that I think it's important for us to start talking about anxiety as not purely a medical phenomenon, and likewise depression. I think this is a conversation that we really need to start having with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Very cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There we'll leave it. Patricia, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Patricia Pearson is the author most recently of A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine. The book is published by Bloomsbury, and you'll find our guest on the web at www.pearsonspost.com. Her name spelled P-E-A-R-S-O-N, Patricia Pearson. Her previous books include the novel Playing House, an essay collection, Area Woman Blows Gasket, and a nonfiction book on female aggression, When She Was Bad. She's a contributing editorial writer for USA Today. Again, A Brief History of Anxiety, published by Bloomsbury.